Welcome to Neuro Noodles, Neurofeedback, and Neuropsychology Podcast featuring tech legend Jay Gunkelman. Our goal is to provide information and promote options for better mental health. My name is Pete, and today Jay Gunkelman is going to discuss addictions. Jay Gunkelman is also going to discuss some people you should know. But before we get to Jay, our show is supported by listeners and businesses just like you, like Gold Supporter, Neuro Guides, Neurofeedback, Neuroimaging Software. Download the free demo now at applyneuroscience.com/neuroguide. Hey guys, attend their pre-conference workshop at the ISNR 2022 conference. You guys heard of ISNR? I hear that's a pretty big thing, Jay.
They've been around in one form or another for quite a while. And are doing quite well as an organization.
Well, NeuroGuide, they have a pre-show workshop Wednesday, July 27th. I guess it's going to be in a hybrid event. Attend the workshop and learn about new additions and techniques of neurofeedback training like cerebellar ROIs and their inclusion in the symptom checklist for both balance and psychiatric disorders, the importance of implementation of cross-frequency coupling training. These topics, along with the fundamental topics of QEG assessment and neurofeedback training, will be covered. Okay, now guys, it's just between us here, and gals. The workshop will be Wednesday, July 27th. And hey, if you want a coupon code, email me, Pete, at neuronoodle.com. I will hook you up. Mary Tracy's Neurotraining Strategies offers a higher standard of EEG, QEG education to EEG clinicians, technicians, and neurofeedback practitioners with convenient online BCAA and QEG certified didactic courses. Register now at EEGstrategies.com. Three things our listeners and viewers can do to help us spread the word of neurofeedback. Number one, subscribe to our YouTube channel. Number two, give us a review on whatever platform you listen to. 5 stars is appreciated, but Jay Gunkelman will accept 4.5 stars. If you have the means, please support us on Patreon/NeuroNoodle. There are different levels in which you can support, whether you're a mom or dad or clinician. There's even an option where you can have your own Q&A with Jay Gunkelman. The money that comes in just helps us support the quality of our content. So Jay, let's kick off the show here with some people that we should know. Who do you got in store for us here?
Well, you know, we've talked a little bit about, and people in the U.S. know Kamiya and Sturman as the kind of the founders of the EEG feedback world, but we're missing out on a European, and the European is Niels Birbaumer. He was at Tübingen University, which is actually a major university center. They discovered circadian rhythms could be seen in research at Tübingen. But he actually interviewed Neil Miller in the very early 70s. So we kind of encountered him a bit when we talked about Neil Miller. But Tübingen University focused on slow cortical potentials, which is the physiological, neuroanatomical, neurophysiological basis for slow cortical potentials in infraslow EEG. And they worked with that to basically train people, first of all, they established the fact that you could control it volitionally. For a normal person, it takes about 4 hours of training to learn how to manipulate positive and negative. And it's level. It's not a wave that's necessarily ongoing. It's a level. And the level can go up in EEG, that's electronegative, to turn on neural networks, and it can go electropositive to turn them off. And they basically utilize the electropositive turns off the network phenomenon to treat epilepsy in the same time frame that Barry Sturman was doing SMR frequency training. They were doing infraslow without that name. It was slow cortical potentials. And the slow cortical potential is essentially the baseline that the EEG rides on. It can go electropositive or electronegative. And again, electronegative turns networks on, electropositive turns them off, and it's generated by glia. So it was a totally different piece of the EEG. They filtered out and threw away the oscillatory EEG that was focused on in the US and we threw away this low critical potential, which is focused on in Europe. There's actually well done efficacy level studies using slow cortical potentials in epilepsy. They've also got good work in the same at the same level for ADD. They simply moved after about 30 years of research at CZ for motor control for epilepsy. They moved forward and are doing it now on ADD. It's a totally different approach. And actually, to understand brain function, you have to integrate both the infra-slow, infra-low, slow critical potential signal with the oscillatory EEG. Consciousness is the relationship between slow cortical potentials and gamma, which is an oscillatory EEG network property. If slow cortical potentials and networks are interacting, you basically have the basis for consciousness. When they decouple, you become less conscious or unconscious. And there's actually a metric used in surgeries, same-day surgeries, called the bispectral index, the BIS index. And the BIS index basically is a box with a number from 0 to 100. And they have one electrode. It's actually concentric electrodes. So it's more than one, but it's one big slab. They say put it on the forehead. It's not because the forehead is where consciousness emerges. It's a distributed network function. It's a spot that doesn't have hair for most people. And for me, I'm getting a little bit more exposure. They could get a few other spots with it if they did one. But the bispectral index at 100, you're wide awake and bushy-tailed and alert. And as you start to get less vigilant, the numbers drop down. If you're in the 80s, you're starting to get dozy. If you're in the 70s, you're probably falling asleep. But if you get into the 60s, that's about where they want to hover you. If you get below 50, you're too deep, and they'll probably have to wake you up after you've been in the hospital for a while, instead of same-day surgery where you can pop back and be able to go home. So they want to hover you deep enough so you don't move or experience the surgery, and they don't want to have you so deep that you have to spend the night. And to do that, same-day surgery, they've done millions and millions of surgeries. A decade ago, they had done over 9 million surgeries with this device. So it's ubiquitous. And the thing is, the anesthesiologist sees the box. They don't know what the box does inside. I've worked with a number of people that were anesthesiologist specialists in drug effects on EEG and all that, but they didn't know the secret formula inside the box. I will tell you the secret formula. They look at 0.38 hertz, and that's infra-slow or infra-low frequency, and they correlate that with gamma at 38 hertz, because the math is easy, 0.38 and 38. If they're related, if they're modulating somewhat together, you're conscious. To the extent that they decouple, you're unconscious. And then in the deep portion of that metric, they actually look for flattening, flat EEG, or burst suppression. And if you've got either of those, you're way too deep. You don't want to get to a zero on this metric. That's a flat line. So the slow cortical potential is a critical piece of brain function. You don't really know brain function fully until you integrate the slow cortical potential and the oscillatory EEG. And again, gamma and infra-slow, infra-low frequency or slow cortical potentials interacting is the biological basis of consciousness. So it's an important thing. And Niels Birbaumer was an academic. In the early 1970s, you could get a list of parts in a circuit board from him, the plot, the diagram of a circuit board, and also the code for a kind of a Pong-like game. And you could do what he was doing. He gave you the software and enough information that you could build your own DC amplifier. For about 100 and something bucks, you could have your own DC amplifier and the Pong-like software to train it. It was a rocket ship. that would have a randomly selected trajectory coming from somewhere on the right-hand edge of the screen. It would slowly come across to the left-hand edge, and you had a window that you could slide up and down. It was electronegative, electropositive. You know, it was, this is your slow cortical potential. And you simply move the window to the rock where the rocket ship can go through it. And as you get better, they speed up the rocket ship. And, you know, it's like Pong, only you don't hit anything back. You just let something go through a window. And it was, you know, obviously very simplistic code, a little simple kind of a box with an arrow on the end of it for the rocket and a window. So as an academic, he literally would give you the hardware, software to be able to replicate what he was doing. Now, slow cortical potential that he showed that it could be trained. And secondly, they applied it because you could turn off a seizure. They applied it to epilepsy. And again, published in Epilepsia, lots of high-level publications across a 30-year period. He retired. And, you know, so have I, you know. So we all get old. At some point, we want to put our feet up a little bit instead of run so hard. And he handed the lab off to Uta Strehl. And Uta's also now retired, mandatory retirement 65 in Germany academics. So she consulted until she was about 70, but she's retired now. And Uta also was a major contributor as a woman in the field. I hope that we do an entire show on the women in the field. But, you know, Pete, I know better than to talk about women without women there. So we'll have to wait until we actually get somebody on the show that can banter back and forth. And
Seaburn will be on next week.
Well, it'll be a perfect topic. And it isn't like we've got to go hunting for women in the field. It's just, I don't think that they've been given an equal share of the PR. And it's a shame because there's some brilliant, brilliant women. We'll talk about quite a few of them next week, hopefully. But today, obviously, Niels Birbaumer is like the topic of the person. And Niels, after he showed that you could control epilepsy, also realized that, you know, we're using the brain to operate this software. How about if we do brain-computer interface and see if we can get somebody who's paralyzed and can't speak even to be able to use a voice synthesizer operating their brain to pick letters off of the screen. It's a P300 or a P3 speller. If you look at the letter that's on the screen, all the letters are on the screen, they'll flicker. And when one of the letters flickers and you're looking at it, they actually see your brain's reaction to that flicker. And they say, oh, he's looking at the Y. Oh, he's looking at the E. Oh, he's looking at the S. Yes. So you can literally spell and then speak. And it takes time. It's not the fastest typer. But if you're totally paralyzed and can't move, typing slowly, you got plenty of time to do it. But if they ended up allowing somebody who's paralyzed to control delivery of water, changing the temperature in the room, selecting pre-typed sentences or phrases. The brain-computer interface was Birbaumer's baby. And the BCI was his lab. So all of the BCIA stuff you see nowadays is basically from his early work. Now, he worked with ALS patients and with total paralysis and reported results. He wasn't the best record keeper, or his students weren't. And there was a challenge to his publication. And he couldn't provide the paperwork and detail to validate the publication. And they actually suggested it was a fraudulent paper. Now, and it had to be pulled from the journal. And the journal basically said it was a fraudulent paper. It wasn't, really. It was just a paperwork error. And the people who said he didn't really do it and it couldn't be done were in fact wrong. Since then, he's actually done an implant into an ALS patient's brain. And that was on the news fairly recently, showing that the person could literally think to speak, not pick letters off of a screen, but literally think of the word, speak the word. He did that with an implanted electrode. So there's higher resolution. Now, unlike Elon Musk, who thinks he's going to just stick those old electrodes in there and the AI is going to learn how you're intending to speak, this isn't how it works. With ALS, when you can't move anymore, there's a learned disability. You don't even try to move. And as such, the AI isn't going to learn how you move because you're not moving. Now, they had a monkey and they got the monkey to play Pong, and the monkey could play Pong with his brain. They learned what the monkey was doing. But if you're not able to do anything and you have a learned disability where you can't even intend anymore, if you have a stroke and you can't use the arm at all, the intention to move the arm isn't even there. There's that learned disability at that point. And you have to do the training before the learned disability, or you need to do biofeedback and have them learn the control. And that's what Birbaumer did with the implanted electrode. That you can't assume your AI is going to learn what the patient wants to do because the patient is no longer even got the intent. So you literally have to train them with neurofeedback. And at that point, they can learn what they need to be doing and operate the brain-computer interface at that point. So Niels was written up recently as a total success, beat Musk to the draw, which isn't that easy to do because obviously, you know, Musk is kind of rapid draw on all sorts of topics. But Birbaumer actually showed he was the real thing and it wasn't some fraud that they had perpetrated. And everybody who was saying, and he sued to get his reputation back, not after he did the successful BCI with an implant, but it was inappropriate for them to disparage him basically at that point. He's trying to get his reputation back. In my book, he never lost his reputation. I did a big favor for Niels way a long time ago in Swansea, Wales. They had a meeting. Society for Applied Neuroscience in Europe is their equivalent of like an ISNR or an AAPB as a European meeting. And it was in Swansea, Wales, and they had the dormitory. The society didn't have any money. They put up their keynote people in the dorm. And, you know, dorms, well, I vaguely remember dorms. They're noisy. People run up and down the hall at 2 a.m. when they get out of the bars. And I actually offered Niels a ride. I saw him walking and it was about to rain. And I was driving back to the hotel I was in, a 5-star hotel down the road a mile or so. Now, this is in Wales. American, I'm driving on the wrong side of the road for me. He was foolish to get in the car with me in the first place, but he wanted to go see Dylan Thomas's museum. He was a big fan. I drove him to the museum and he said, "Oh my God, the dorm's so awful." I said, "If I can get you a room in this 5-star hotel, will you take it?" And he said, "Could you? Would you?" And I said, "I'm going to try." And he went to the museum, got a cab back to the meeting. At the meeting, I basically gave him a key to his hotel room, and it was a beautiful, gorgeous 5-star hotel room. So he said he owed me, and in 2005, I had him and his programmer, Sitaram, come over to the U.S. to program the functional MRI feedback device in San Diego for Dr. Hubbard. And it was an applied fMRI for feedback. That was what it was built for. And you can buy a Siemens Tesla, 3 Tesla scanner, but you can't get it programmed from Siemens. You've got to have that done, you know, professionally by somebody who knows how to do it. And very few do. Citarum was the programmer who set that up for him. Anyway, we go way back, and he's an old friend. He's not well, but then most people my age aren't well, so it's not a surprise. He's somebody that you should know about, somebody that we all need to honor as one of our founders. What I'd like to do today is talk a little bit about addiction. And okay. We actually did a study. This is basically going to be the PowerPoint about that study. I'll actually show the paper as well. This is a case series. It's not a control study. There's no control group. There's no randomization. This is just 30 people that went through therapy. And we are doing this study to see what are the phenotypes that are seen in addiction. Nobody had looked at the phenotype model in this particular population. So we wanted to see what kind of phenotypes there were in this population. And to look at the effect of therapy that was driven by the phenotypes. Now, you have to realize that addiction is an awful circumstance. And if you spend money on treatment, you get a giant reduction in your overall cost. There's a savings ratio. Again, outpatient programs ratio about 12 to 1. For every dollar you spend, you save 12. So and obviously a huge expense associated with it. But, you know, if you're going to claim that you can treat something, you have to actually meet certain standards. Our field set up its own set of standards. We have a template for developing evaluation of whether something could be claimed as being efficacious. It has possibly efficacious, probably efficacious, and then specific. If you're the best approach, then you get to be called a specific. You're better than other approaches. So this was actually done when Don Moss and I were president. I was president of ISNR and he was president of AAPB. And we did this collaboratively, published in both journals. This is actually the efficacy status of biofeedback and neurofeedback for addiction, substance use disorder. And they came up with ratings of probably efficacious for both the Peniston protocol, which was developed in the late 80s by Gene Peniston and Kalkulski, out of Menninger, having studied off of Elmer and Elise Green. And also the Scott protocol, Bill and Cora Scott. And they realized in the Scott protocol, which came much later, that you actually had to do some pre-treatment before you jumped into alpha theta. Well, Peniston did some pre-treatment as well, but his pre-treatment was peripheral feedback, temperature training and electrodermal training, tapped into the sympathetic nervous system. And that was trained before they got into the alpha theta style training. The Scott protocol does some EEG biofeedback, EEG neurofeedback, in order to reduce any alpha or theta deviations that you have prior to the alpha theta training. They've seen that avoid some of the negative potential side effect. If you train alpha up and you've got too much alpha up front from a depressive presentation, and you're training alpha theta for addiction, you may actually worsen the depressive presentation unless you deal with that frontal alpha first. So Bill and Cora Scott's protocol sort of replaced the Peniston protocol in order to pre-treat some of the cases before they jumped into alpha theta. Now, what did we find? Well, we found in an N of 30 people, 2/3 of the people had an overarousal. So we're at this point. So what we basically found in the study is that there's two drive mechanisms underlying addiction. 2/3 of the people we studied had overarousal. 1/3 of the people we studied had an OCD drive. And they're two totally separate kinds of drive mechanism. and they're seen in the endophenotype model as different EEG patterns. If you have an over-aroused EEG, from the 2005 original phenotype paper, we tell you you do some SMR training and then you go to alpha theta training. If you have fast alpha, which is again over arousal, you get alpha theta training. You go straight to alpha theta training.
Our show is supported by listeners and businesses just like you, like Gold Supporter, Neuro Guides, Neurofeedback, Neuroimaging Software. Download the free demo now at applyedneuroscience.com/neuroguide. Hey guys, attend their pre-conference workshop at the ISNR 2022 conference. They have a pre-show workshop Wednesday, July 27th. I guess it's going to be in a hybrid event. Attend the workshop and learn about new additions and techniques of neurofeedback training like cerebellar ROIs and their inclusion in the symptom checklist for both balance and psychiatric disorders, the importance of implementation of cross-frequency coupling training. These topics, along with the fundamental topics of QEG assessment and neurofeedback training, will be covered. Okay, now, guys, it's just between us here and gals. The workshop will be Wednesday, July 27th. And hey, if you want a coupon code, email me, Pete@neuronoodle.com. I will hook you up.
And if you have beta spindles, you get SMR and then alpha theta. So the over arousal people all got alpha theta training, not because they had addiction, but because they had over-arousal. The training was designed based on the phenotype finding, not based on their DSM behavioral cluster. So the other people had an OCD feature, an anterior cingulate finding. And what we basically see is that it's an FZ location, and they either had alpha or slow or beta. And you basically had to work frontally, not at the back of the head like you do with OCD, with addiction, classically with alpha theta. And all of the over-arousal ended up with alpha theta at the back of the head. So it's two separate approaches. Now, low voltage fast EEG has essentially no background alpha. This is from 8 to 12. This is the alpha band, and this is the low voltage fast person. They needed to have some SMR training and then alpha theta. But this is simply exposing them to alcohol, which is a very common circumstance. If you're a low voltage fast EEG and you run into alcohol, it's suddenly going to start to give you alpha. Time one, two shots of alcohol, literally 2 ounce shots of a hard liquor. And you can see alpha starting to light up here. Two more shots. Well, alpha's pretty strong now. Two more shots, alpha starts to slow. We're losing some of the faster alpha. We're slipping into the slower frequencies. Most people start here with alpha. And as such, they're already where you will be four shots in. They take two shots and therefore you will take six. You can see a low voltage fast EEG is going to have a slippery slope when they start to end up with alcohol because it makes them feel normal. And they're going to use it to titrate. Now, titrating your alpha by sipping on alcohol all day long is not really an effective strategy. It's not going to go well. And people tend to slip past the spot at which they've got alpha and they slip into the theta state and get sloppy and drunk. It's not just the two shots to get a little social lubrication, sloppy drunk. A low voltage fast EEG is seen in families of alcoholics and in alcoholics. And you don't have to be the drinker to have the pattern. It's a genetically linked pattern. Gene number 4, GABA-A receptors. GABA-A receptors are produced in excess. You can't saturate them all, so you're over-aroused. You need more GABA to become normal because you've got too many receptors. And as such, you start to consume alcohol. And alcohol is a kind of a bad way to get your GABA. Better to learn how to do it yourself. These are cingulate patterns. This is a low voltage fast EEG. you can see Z-scores. These are all negative Z-scores until you get up into the beta band when they start to have some normal values. Again, low voltage, fast record. This is fast alpha, 11, 12 hertz alpha peak, maybe even up at 13. So it's obviously Z-scores and it's faster than it should be. You got reasonably normal amounts of some of the slow stuff, but the alpha peak itself sits faster than normal at 12, 13 hertz. That's also an overarousal. Again, fast alpha. Beta spindles. I've got better examples of the beta spindles. We'll look at those as EEGs in a second. So what did they do? They did standard 12-step type clinical model, group therapy, individual therapies, normal things. They just added in neurofeedback on top of the normal 12-step program. Now, a really good 12-step program with fabulous staff and good facility and, yeah, kind of making sure that the people that are in there are, in fact, looking for therapy and not just trying to dodge the law or something. A really good 12-step program gets about a third of the people to be clean and sober at the end of their training. There's a recidivism that's fairly substantial in addiction. And people quite often need multiple trips to therapy in order to finally get something to kick in. But about a 30% success. Peniston showed a 70% success, which is a gigantic jump forward. You know, twice as good as a normal program using the Alpha Theta protocol from Peniston. And his work was in the late 90s. Now, we had already done alpha training in the 1970s. We wrote a grant for alpha training in alcoholics in 1974, which was not funded. But we'd already done alpha training in alcoholics and found it to be very successful. So when we did this study, we added neurofeedback into these standard protocol 12-step programs. So what did we see? Well, Royal College of Medicine, John Grazellier in London, John Grazellier did alpha theta training and it reduced beta. In a normal person that has some alpha, it doesn't really change the alpha or theta density. It reduces beta. You're training hypoperfusion and you're getting rid of hyperperfusion. So that's the basic thing that happened. We reduced the overarousal patterns with the alpha theta style training. Dr. Marco Congito, who brought Loretta over to the United States when he was a student in Lubar's lab, we sent he and Leslie Sherlin over to Zurich to learn how to do Loretta because it was written in Pascal, which is almost impossible for most people to work with. And they brought it back so it could be used with neurofeedback. But he found that you could train the anterior cingulate. And when you train the anterior cingulate, you got changes in the obsessive compulsive disorder. And so anterior cingulate working, we worked with the OCD. What happened? Well, at 1 year follow-up, you can repeat a Woodcock-Johnson 3. And this is GIA, which is like IQ. They went from a standard score of 99 to a score of 120. Now, that's going from normal to, you know, better than normal, kind of superior intellect. Not off scale, but definitely a substantial brightening. Thinking ability. 103, normal, to 122, superior. Cognitive efficiency, 94.7 to 118. Again, standard score normalish to standard score superior-like. So all of these are improvements. Audiovisual learning, 88, which isn't a great score, to 112 is better than normal, but just a bit better. This is what was really dramatic. A 65 delayed recall score, if you tell them at the beginning of the session, I'm going to stick this $10 bill under my keyboard on the computer. In a half an hour, if you remember what it is and where it is, you can get it. And at the end of the half hour, you'd have a good chance of keeping it. This delayed recall score is just terrible. Now, it's not just this one person at the bottom end of this that's making this whole thing bad. The mean here is 65. The mean here is 103. There's still an outlier at either end, but the group average ends up moving up to 103. So it's not just one bad person who slipped up into the norm. The mean here went from 65 to 103. So a substantial improvement in memory function, working memory, 93 to 122. And this was Crossroads, and my business partner at the time, who ran the addiction centers, was Curtis Kripe. I actually had to dissolve the company. He had a major accident and was almost paralyzed. He had a rollover vehicle accident. He was partially ejected, and the truck rolled over on him, broke his both scapula and shoulders. And it, you know, a year later, he was still not really fully functional. And yeah, his buy-in to the company was all of his addiction centers. He had quite a few. Unfortunately, we paid him a salary for a year, and at that point, it was obvious he's not going to end up with his centers back intact. And what do you do? Folded the company and gave it to him.
On the alcohol side, there's a couple of ways people can consume it. They can binge it. They binge it, and then they had too much, and then they black out. Is that they're getting offline? Is that the hippocampus? What's going on where they forget and you can't remember anymore? What's going on there?
Well, when your arousal level drops to a certain extent, you remember in the vigilance model, there's an alpha dropout. Your alpha anteriorizes, and then the anterior becomes more prominent, and then eventually the alpha drops out and slow stuff happens. When you've got the alpha dropping out, that's the reticular nucleus of the thalamus not providing acetylcholine anymore. And if you don't have thalamic rhythmicity, your encoding memory stuff is just not efficiently present. You're going to have an absence of memory for that period because there's no ability to lay down the substrate for memory. And unfortunately, it's all too easy to get to that point if you're a chronic consumer. You've accommodated it to the point where you're dropping your arousal level. When you slip beyond the alpha band into the theta band and your alpha drops out entirely, you know, you can drive a car when you're in stage one sleep, drowsiness. People do it all the time. I got to exit 20. How did I get here? Last one I remember is exit 5. I mean, I went from 5 to 20 and I don't know how I got here. Well, you were in your lane. You didn't crash into the barriers. You didn't, you know, run into the car in front of you. You're on highway hypnosis, autopilot, but you don't really lay down a memory. How did I get here? Well, I don't have a memory of it. I was in this state where I'm not making memory. I'm kind of on autopilot. And you get to that state with this alpha dropout. So it's not uncommon. Passive aggressive personality, habitual excessive drinking, PAPHED, was one of the diagnostic categories at the state hospital. The other one was episodic excessive drinking, EED, instead of, you know, habitual excessive. It's episodic excessive. So people that would go on a binge had a different DSM cluster thrown at them. Now, those were categorizations in the 1970s at a state hospital, and there's probably better descriptions at this point. But
and then on the other side is if they're not binging, but they'll drink every single day a certain amount. Is that just to get their alphas going, or
that's habitual excessive? That's to drop their arousal level so they feel like they're functional. And if you're so over aroused, you're so anxious and agitated and twitchy that you need a couple of beers to just calm the nerves. And that's, you know, you can see the low voltage fast EEG as a predisposing factor in a case like that.
Some people complain that they've lost their taste for their drug of choice. What is going on here?
Well, if you eliminate the drive, you lose your taste for it. There's no drive towards it anymore. And things that you're driven towards give you satisfaction. things you need to give you satisfaction. But if you don't have a need anymore, it loses its taste. Now, I've lost my pituitary, and there's times that I need salts, and people will hand me a Gatorade sometimes. And if I need the salts, the Gatorade tastes like the nectar of the gods. It's absolutely fabulous. If I have enough salts in me already, it tastes like salty brine swill, and you just about spit it out. I was in Arizona at Carefree at a meeting for ISNR, and it was hot. I was dehydrating so bad. Somebody gave me three giant bottles of Gatorade, a couple of different flavors. One of those giant jars of Gatorade disappeared. Just glug, 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 glug. I felt like I was swashy, but it absorbed instantaneously, and another one followed it. I was so dehydrated, and water doesn't do it. Water flushes salts. So I was, and the problem with no pituitary is you don't have vasopressin, so you don't regulate your kidney function, so you dump water. And I couldn't keep up drinking water as flushing salt. And at that point, you go hypokalemic and your heart stops. So, you know, the high probable death of, with no pituitary is either imbalance of salt or an immune trigger that that you didn't get on top of early enough, and your immune system will take you out. I've got some EEGs here. This one is an EEG that's absolutely full of fast activity. Look at this. This is his background alpha. But look at the frequency. 1, 2, 3 is 15. Now, when was 15 hertz alpha? Well, Reed Niedermeyer is called fast alpha from 11 to 16. And this is fast alpha. And his EEG is essentially a lower voltage, faster EEG with alpha that's tuned up so fast that he's grossly over-aroused. And you can see the buzz that's in the EEG with fast activity in the beta band. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. That's about a 25 hertz rhythm. And 15 hertz alpha slowed down here into the alpha band at about probably 8, 9. But this is a drowsier moment in the record. But this is over arousal. And again, over arousal is one of the drive mechanisms. Two-thirds of the addicted population have that. But in this case, we have beta spindles at the anterior cingulate. And I'm going to, I've got eye movements in this and everything. I'm just going to do this just to chop out the more obvious big eye movements. They'll be underlined in blue so they won't be analyzed. It saves us time. And what I'm going to do is get the spectra of this file. Shoot, it didn't pop open. You can see the beta. My apologies for the software crapping out. I got quite a few copies of EEG open. This is a theta variety of an anterior cingulate. You can see anterior cingulates at the frontal midline. This is left frontal, left posterior, right temporal, just like you're looking straight down at the top of the head. And you can see this mapped gives us an anterior cingulate theta frequency. And the anterior cingulate has three failure modes. You can fail with theta, you can fail with alpha, and you can fail with beta. They look the same clinically. And you think, well, how can theta and beta look the same clinically? Well, the anterior cingulate's not working. When it's working, you have cognitive and emotional flexibility. When it's not working, you lose that flexibility. You're either locked on like an obsessive compulsive, oppositional defiant person, or you're locked off like a amotivation, lack of initiation, procrastination So we can only say that it's not working, and it's either going to be locked on or off. So the behavior is going to show you really quickly which one of those it is. But if you can't see that this is the anterior cingulate, you need to go see your eye doctor. You know, we could do source analysis and all that, but this is an anterior cingulate theta failure mode. The alpha failure mode and slow alpha failure mode here is another alternative to how the frontal cingulate can end up failing. And this particular EEG is both an obsessive compulsive, and you can see FP1, FP2 are bigger than F3, F4. So this is the rostral anterior cingulate, not the cognitive division, but the affective division of the anterior cingulate. And this is an alpha failure mode. So you can fail in beta, which unfortunately I didn't get to pop up the spectra. You can fail in alpha, and you can fail in theta. Whichever one of those are the problem, you basically get rid of the peak that's at the frontal midline. When that's attenuated, you end up having the anterior cingulate back online, giving you the cognitive and emotional flexibility, so you don't have the obsessive compulsive drive towards addiction. Penniston got 70% success because 2/3 of the addicted population have alpha theta as their required intervention. We got 100% success because we treated the other 1/3 at the anterior cingulate. You can't treat everybody with the same protocol. In fact, the alpha theta protocols had subtle differences in the beta spindle and low voltage fast. We did some SMR training just before the alpha theta. But alpha theta ends up helping with over arousal features. If you've got an anterior cingulate feature, you've got to go forward to the frontal midline, not just work at the back of the head. So the standard protocol, if you have addiction, you can look it up in the literature and it'll say alpha theta. But not everybody has the biomarkers that indicate that that's the pattern. 2/3 will have it, which is why it shows itself to be effective. And 1/3 don't have a success with it. And when you add an anterior cingulate approach for those, you end up treating everybody with their own individualized approach. And, you know, evidence-based medicine and personalized medicine are big kind of, you know, words, but this is personalizing and it's evidence-based. And I would suggest if you've got somebody who's addicted and you have a chance to look at their EEG patterns, you can predict what kind of therapy they're going to respond to. If you can match the person with the effective therapy, you save them messing around with therapies that aren't going to be terribly effective. Nothing wrong if you have alpha up front with learning how to control alpha theta at the back of the head, except it might have a symptom triggered by the alpha training because you got an excess alpha up here. And if you train alpha up before you dealt with the excess alpha up front, you end up having a side effect. This is a low voltage fast EEG. These are Z-scores. There's a little bit of 1 hertz, which is probably just baseline bounce. You see the deficits across the rest of this. This is log correction, a log transform, and it gets rid of power, and it's a log transform of magnitude. So you end up seeing the fast activity exaggerated. It corrects for the 1/F. One faster the frequency, the smaller you are in EEG, and this corrects for that. But you can still see in absolute terms, this is a low voltage fast EEG, and yeah, the low voltage of some fast activity bumping into a normal range. This is the publication we saw the PowerPoint for. This is Curtis and myself, a special issue of the biofeedback. It's a magazine-like, but it's a peer-reviewed journal. So this is the paper. and I did the PowerPoint because all of those graphs that I showed you are summarized here. And I thought that the curves actually had some data in them that would be of some utility looking at. Anyway.
Well, Jay, thank you. Thank you so much. Another Jay Gunkelman patent pending screen share.
No patent. I'm always happy to share everything I've got. When I do lectures, I hand out a folder that's full of papers, many of which we didn't necessarily focus on during the talk. So,
we'll have many more talks, Jay. We'll have many more talks.
Hopefully.
Oh, hope is not a strategy. We're going to have so many more. All right. Hey, we thank you all for watching NeuroNoodles, Neurofeedback, and Neuropsychology Podcast. We'd like to say, hey, thank you for all that Patreon love. My gold supporter, NeuroGuides, Neurofeedback, Neuroimaging Software. Download the free demo now at applyedneuroscience.com/NeuroGuide. Hey, guys, attend their pre-conference workshop at the ISNR 2022 conference. They have a pre-show workshop Wednesday, July 27th. I guess it's going to be in a hybrid event. Attend the workshop and learn about new additions and techniques of neurofeedback training like cerebellar ROIs and their inclusion in the symptom checklist for both balance and psychiatric disorders, the importance of implementation of cross-frequency coupling training. These topics, along with the fundamental topics of QEG assessment and neurofeedback training, will be covered. Okay, now, guys, it's just between us here and gals. The workshop will be Wednesday, July 27th. And hey, if you want a coupon code, email me, pete@neuronoodle.com. I will hook you up. Mary Tracy's Neurotraining Strategies offers a higher standard of EEG, QEG education to EEG clinicians, technicians, and neurofeedback practitioners with convenient online BCIA and QEG certified didactic courses. Three things our listeners and viewers can do to help us spread the word of neurofeedback. Number one, subscribe to our YouTube channel. Number two, give us a review on whatever platform you listen to. 5 stars is appreciated, but Jay Gunkelman will accept 4.5 stars. If you have the means, please support us on Patreon/NeuroNoodle. There are different levels in which you can support, whether you're a mom or dad or clinician. There's even an option where you can have your own Q&A with Jay Gunkelman. The money that comes in just helps us support the quality of our content. Okay, guys, we thank you all for listening. Cue the non-copyrighted music.